It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skifty and Fanny Show, episode 6.4.
When genre fiction comes with a steamy new twist.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we have with us today Giselle Vanderhooft. I hope I said the last name right.
It's actually Vanderhooft, but I forgive you.
Oh, okay. Vanderhooft.
It's all good. It's all good.
I love your
it's
partner.
A hard name.
In the
it's
background.
A hard name. It's all right.
It was good. Well, welcome to the show, by the way.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself first off, so that people know who you are.
Well, hi-ho. Sorry, I had to do a Muppets tribute there. Anyway, hi, I'm Joe Vanderhooft. I write and edit all the things. I'm an author and editor equally, and mostly lately I've been editing lesbian anthologies, some of which we're probably going to talk a little bit about today. These include Hellebore and Rue with Catherine Lundoff, my co-editor, Heiresses of Russ, which is just coming out in early December from Letha Press. Steve Berman and I put that together. It's a best of lesbian spec fic from 2010. Got some really, really good authors in there like N.K. Jemisin, Catherine Lundoff again, and Zen Cho, who's also in Steam Powered. It's a really, really good collection. And I've just kind of started a job recently as a full-time freelance editor, and I edit pretty much any book that comes my way. Which means that my life is very busy, and yet outside of the exciting adventures of literature, very boring. Go figure.
Well, excellent. So we had you on today partly to talk about your latest book, Steam Powered 2, but also to sort of talk about LGBT genre fiction, and probably really LGBT fiction in general.
Sure.
Kind of a roundtable, the three of us, since obviously if anyone who listens to the show, everyone knows Jen and I are pretty much A-okay with lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual fiction, although we don't get a lot of it. What the heck?
Okay with this? Seriously?
Wow. Yeah. Sorry. I know we're weird that way.
<It's> surprising.
But we don't actually get a lot that's been billed as that kind of where the central character is of the variety of potentials, which is actually kind of odd. I would have thought that we would have.
However, I was pleasantly surprised to receive J.A. Pitt's series that starts with Black Blade Blues, and the second book is Honeyed Words. The main character is a lesbian, and it's actually done respectfully. Which was nice, because a lot of the time you have lesbians that are the wishy-washy America likes lesbians.
Or they're what are called bargain basement lesbians, or bargain lesbians. I think it's bargain basement lesbians on TV Tropes, where there's something about them that makes them technically not lesbians. We can talk about that a little further down the line. I mean, I'm sorry. It's been a long day, and I'm making it sound very, very strange. But it's basically, for example, there's an anime I really like called Simone, where it's basically a single sex society as long as you're a child. But when you turn 17 or 18, you have to pick whether you're going to continue being female or you're going to become male. So there's some argument in that as to, okay, if you are, because this is a Yuri anime, meaning kind of lesbian, basically. So there's kind of an argument, okay, so if these are, you know, kids who haven't really chosen a sex yet, and they're in a female-female relationship, are they lesbians? I'm sorry, that was a huge tangent.
No,
that's
but that's
actually
a big
really
question. Yeah.
Right, that's an interesting concept, and
yeah.
I mean,
but
I think
see that a lot. Oh, sorry, Jen.
No, go ahead.
I see that a lot, actually, and not just in animation, but it always seems like there's one kind of my pet peeves with lesbian or bi female characters is always like there's some, we've got to kind of question that, like, was it because of abuse, or is it, you know, something as great as Simone is it because it's a single sex society from birth until you make this choice, or they're always, or not always, but there often seems to be something complicating it. Like, we just don't quite have the courage to take that last little step. And that's, it's nice to see, you know, some representation, but that can get a little irksome after a while, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I was just thinking related to this. I mean, I just saw the movie Chasing Amy.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Which supposedly is a comedy, but I thought it was the most depressing movie. It was not, I mean, it was funny at moments, but mostly it just, you got to the end of it and you're like, this is not happy. None of this ends happy. And for those who've not seen Chasing Amy, the woman who's not named Amy, it's Alyssa, but the myth is called Chasing Amy. But anyway, she's a lesbian and this guy doesn't realize it at first. He kind of, it's Ben Affleck, and he's talking to her and he falls in love with her, and he realizes finds out she's a lesbian, but they keep being friends, and he falls in love and he confesses his love for her, and then magically she decides, well, you're the perfect person in my whole life, so I can totally forget that I'm not attracted to your male bits. But then it complicates it, and when you find out she's really bi, so she was never a lesbian, and this whole smorgasbord, and they just kind of pass over the whole issue of the fact that she sort of basically just threw out her entire lesbianness for, I don't know if anyone's seen it, but you get to the end of it and it's kind of depressing in every possible way because nobody ends up
happy.
It's
interesting.
And
it's interesting because I mean, I haven't seen that movie in years, so I could watch it now and be completely, utterly, totally appalled and be like, oh my God, what was I thinking? But I remember when that came out, I was probably about 15, 16, and I remember something Alyssa says, and I'm going to butcher the quote because I haven't seen it forever, but it was something along the lines of that she was attracted to the person, not the gender. And as someone who is, I mean, more lesbian identified than bisexual, but is, you know, technically bi, although I don't really date men right now, I found that to be really kind of refreshing and revelatory for me, you know, as a 15-year-old growing up in Salt Lake City. I mean, I'm just saying it. I could watch it again and be like, "What the hell?" I was really deprived, but at the time, it was kind of meaningful for me. But yeah, I mean, it definitely is a problematic movie, no question.
Yeah, and I think it's mostly the problem is that you don't find out she's bi till way after they've kind of hooked up together.
Mm-hmm.
And if that had been at the forefront the whole time, it would never have been as much of a controversy in the film itself. Because, you know, if you're bi, you like both sexes, so there's no issue there. But the fact is they that's never brought up until the end, basically, that you find out she's bisexual.
And
so this whole time...
Kind of...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go, Jen. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I think that's kind of the problem with not all, obviously, but people who don't identify as LGBTQ writing characters who are. Oh my goodness! I'm so sorry. My phone just went off.
I'm gonna kill you, Jen.
That's okay. I hung up.
what?
I didn't want to take the phone call anyway. is that things like bisexuality becomes an easy out to make things, you know, less black and white in terms of who the characters are, what their identities are, and it makes it easier in terms of a broader acceptance of characters because, as I said, you know, it's like that lesbians are okay in America because they're sexy. And it goes with bisexuality as well because, oh, if a lesbian's bisexual, then, oh, good, the man can have her. So it ends up making it just a simplistic sort of sex view as opposed to a relationship and identity view.
But at the same time, I think that, I mean, granted, I may say something completely different if I were to sit down and, you know, watch the movie and come back and talk to you about it. But at the same time, I think also maybe they made Kevin Smith made Alyssa lesbian and then suddenly not because of kind of internalized biphobia that American society really has.
Hmm.
It seems like, I mean, if he had wanted to just kind of you know, identify her as bisexual from the start, I mean, that's probably right. what her identity was, but it seems like we couldn't quite just go there, because I really think, well, on the one hand, it's interesting, because I see that there are two separate things going on here. On the one hand, yes, bisexuality is an easy out, I think, especially when you're dealing with, you know, lesbians and, well, women and lesbians who are kind of a subset of an already marginalized group, right?
Right.
Where you can say, oh, no, it's okay, because ultimately it's all about how men desire them, and, yeah, there is that one exception, right? Or they can, or yeah, they're straight for you, but not for anyone else. Isn't that hot? And that certainly happens. But at the same time, I think it's also that we're very rigid in the United States, at least in predominant white culture. I can't really speak for any other culture here, about where you fall in a kind of a neat little package, right? You're either definitely straight, you're definitely gay, or you're definitely lesbian. If there's any kind of fluidity, people freak out.
Yes,
that's true. And I do,
like, they can't handle it.
Yeah, and I think, to kind of be fair to Chasing Amy, I mean, I'm a little bit unfair to it. There is a lot in that that film about homophobia, biphobia, that sort of internalized phobia, because even one of the characters, played by the guy from Earl, Banky, right? He's a closet gay. He and every thing that he says is essentially just really, really violent homophobic stuff. But he's gay, and he knows he's gay. And that happens, I think. You get a lot of characters who are like that in that film, that are refusing to accept who they are. And that's actually even not just with the sexuality. That has to do with, I mean, there's the character, the black gay man in it, who's a comic book writer, and he, in order to sell comic books, he pretends to be like a black power guy.
I don't even remember that character. Oh, man.
He's so important to the movie, and everything he says, anytime he talks to like a little kid, like he talks to this little black kid one moment, and he's like, look at that man over there, and he's pointing to Ben Affleck, and he's like, you know, Whitey's the man, you gotta fight the man. He does this whole speech.
Kevin Smith, that's problematic.
It is problematic, but it is really fascinating, because all of the characters, I think, are all very confused about, or confused, or in some ways are playing with these sort of issues of identity in very different ways. And it's certainly a problematic film, but now I'm thinking about it as, like, maybe I should watch it again.
And that seems to be kind of to me, and I haven't read much, I'll be completely honest, but the little I have read, and including Steam Powered, is that that issue of identity and complicated identity and you know, what you are, what you're becoming, what you've always been, is kind of a central tenet of a lot of what I've read, LGBTQ fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because the characters are usually in a world where it's not accepted,
or less accepted.
Is accepted, less accepted, etc. Obviously, which is a central tenet of modern day American life. So
It's interesting, in Steam Powered Sense, and thank you, Jen, I hope you liked it.
I did.
I'm glad. Thank you. It's always good when I hear that. It's interesting in both Steam Powered 1 and 2, but I think a little more so in 2, if I'm speaking just off the cuff. Just looking, Jamie Goh, who is one of the authors in Steam Powered 2, did a phenomenal series of interviews with a lot of the authors on her blog, Silver Goggles, which I encourage everybody to Google. If you have a copy of the book, the last page tells you the URL where you can go and read them. But it was interesting to see a lot of the authors talking about the backstories for this world and saying that either lesbianism was either accepted or, you know, kind of ignored because, hey, they're women, right? And who cares? You know, kind of like the world we know, or it was frowned upon, but, you know, not really punished. And I just found that really interesting, because sometimes that comes up in the stories themselves, and sometimes it really does not. I'm thinking, for example, of Sean Holland's story, Playing Chess in New Persepolis, where it's that you wouldn't know unless you'd read that interview that it was taking place in a world where it was kind of frowned upon, but, you know, they kind of let you go as long as you didn't scare the horses, you know, and do it in the streets.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, actual Victorian saying, not mine. Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to, you know, and it was interesting to get wrapped up the fact that it's steampunk. So steampunk allows, you know, a playing with the traditional Victorian values, and some of the stories just kind of threw the values out and kept the world, and then added the steam technology.
Yeah,
and others were very much playing with the traditional Victorian cultural norms. And what the only thing that I wish I had seen was it would be a story that deals with the later in life lesbians, who the women who, for whatever reason, have divorced, you know, have two children, and is a common occurrence. Or the women who live together, have been lesbians their entire lives, but still have to pretend to be, you know, just a couple of spinsters. Like the whole spinster thing that occurred frequently in Victorian times and was never dealt with as they're probably lesbians. But
well, it depends on the situation. I mean,
it does.
There was an issue with two fully grown people of the same sex living, depending on where you are during the Victorian time. And it would be very interesting to see a story. How do two women who've been living together for so long navigate a society where that is?
I fully agree. And if I may just take a moment, anybody listening who's thinking of submitting to Steam Powered 3 starting January 1st, if you went to college, remember that moment in college when the professor said, this will be on the test? Well, I want to see a story like this. Please
Yay!
Send me one. This will be on the test or something.
Excellent.
Awesome.
Because
excellent.
I think it's just an interesting way to, because of what, when you're looking at the cultural norms of Victorian times, whereas steampunk likes to kind of not always throw it out, but very frequently it's not necessarily a requirement of steampunk, because steampunk allows for women to be feminists, essentially.
In some cases, yes.
In some cases. In other cases...
Because, keep in mind, the whole suffragette movement was really, you know, taking off in a lot of the West at that time. So you have that clashing right up against this technology.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think the problem Jen is trying to get at is that a lot of steampunk sort of ignores what was really going on in those moments in order to kind of give us this fancy, happy version of of that world.
No, absolutely. And in fact, you've touched upon a debate that's really been going on in steampunk for, you know, I'm definitely more than a few years, but has really been very prominent in the last few years, is really kind of that whole aesthetic and kind of really sticking with, you know, it's set in England and everybody's white, with, you know, making it not only really dealing with very uncomfortable issues that were around in that time period or that were brought about by that technology as with regarding, you know, sexism, homophobia, colonialism, racism, empire, and it's certainly, you know, you'll find people who want, you know, just their goggles and ether toys, and, you know, want us to leave all the, you know, unshiny bits out, and I mean while there I think there can be value in you know some escapism, I'm not a big fan of that. I like to see steampunk that messes with, you know, the grittier issues, because it's not escapism for a lot of people.
Well, my question is, why is it that you can't have escapism while dealing... I mean, I can understand, like, you don't want to have a story that's bogged down by every possible issue of the time, but couldn't you have a story that maybe was... There's rip-roaring adventure in a steampunk world with, like, airships and pirate battle, like, you know, the Three Musketeer movies with the cool airship battles, but at the same time is also dealing with slavery.
No, absolutely. I'm sorry if I seem to have given the impression I didn't think that. No, I'm totally all for that. I think what I was trying to say was escapism with regard to, you know, oh, with regard to there's, you know, unchecked racism or sexism going on in the story, but, you know, hey, if we actually say that's problematic or that's racist, then, you know, how dare you ruin my fun? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I was more going against people who don't want to write that don't think that somehow addressing, even just somewhat addressing some of the issues, that they think that's, you still can't have an escapist story. And it's like,
oh,
well,
no, you can have the funnest story ever and deal with that. I mean, I love, you know, swashbuckling high romance stuff. I mean, not a whole anthology of it, but I don't want a whole anthology of anything necessarily.
Yeah. See, this is, and just the thinking, just going on the slavery thing. Mm-hmm. I'm serious. What would happen if you had a steampunk universe to the Underground Railroad? Like, would you have had slave groups, like, with the slave revolts? Would they have, like, stolen airships and, like, went careening through the sky and attacking other airships? Like, can you imagine? Like,
everybody, this will be on the test. Seriously. Interestingly enough, I did have one contributor who had an idea for an Underground Railroad story. She ended up not for the first volume. She ended up submitting something else, but that was an idea she mentioned to me. So I want to see that happen someday. I mean, I don't know what it would look like. I would love to see someone tell me what they think it would look like.
It would be awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, challenge accepted.
That's the nice thing about genre, period, but mm-hmm. steampunk definitely gives you a very interesting palette to play with, or landscape, rather, is that you can explore really complicated issues and have the, you know, high-flying adventure and
absolutely
the swashbuckling and the airships and the slave revolts with airships, because that would be spiffy.
and it's so interesting to me because, I mean, I stop me if I'm going too far left field here, but What I really think is interesting about steampunk is that, you know, the gears and steam aside, although steampunk doesn't necessarily have to have either, I find it very similar to a lot of concerns we're going through right now. We're in an age of incredible technological development that we're not entirely sure what's going to happen with, whether it's going to help us or hurt us, and is probably doing a lot of both, with regards to, you know, the internet, with regards to globalization. And we're dealing with a time of incredible social upheaval, which, you know, really, as staid as the Victorian era was, remember, we have the abolition movement, we have women's rights starting up in the suffragette movement. In 1848, we have pretty much all of Europe revolting all at once. Seriously, check out that year. It was bizarre. Every century is tumultuous, but I think, you know, the 1800s specifically and the time of Queen Victoria was just, you know, very, had a lot going on. And a lot of the same fears we have today and the same preoccupations we have today. Sorry, Jen.
Right. No, the industrialization did a lot to complicate people's worldviews. I mean, you have the massive globalization, you know, it's kind of started at that point in time. And the need for cheap labor was suddenly mm-hmm. even more pronounced. And women obviously going, okay, well, to be honest, although we kind of forced the whole women start working out of the home in the, you know, 1950s or whatever, World War II, it started happening much longer ago. It started with industrialization, with the mm-hmm. warehouse or the manufacturing. And
yeah. And that's a good point. Keep in mind also that, you know, women working outside of the home is, you know, and kind of a, you know, shock at that, is really a very upper middle to upper class white phenomenon. I mean, poor women, white women, have long worked outside of the home. Women of color, you know, almost always. It's really fascinating to me that, you know, we tend not to think of that. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you were, I mean, I'm reading Les Miserables right now, rereading it, which is kind of interesting to be reading during, you know, Occupy Wall Street. I didn't plan it that way, but it just sort of happened. And it's interesting to me to find out that, I mean, yeah, Fantine is, you know, a working mother, basically, and she's poor.
Right.
So, I mean, she was definitely not, you know, relying on, I mean, she could have relied on the guy, but he sort of ran off and just abandoned her. But, I mean, that was definitely going on, and that was, see, 1860 that Les Miserables, 1862 that it gets published. So, yeah, long before we had, you know, post-World War II when all the women were supposed to go back to the homes and just said no. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or in America, at least, it was not the same everywhere else.
Because suddenly it's when the upper middle class white woman went, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, we get it. This is kind of nice.
Yeah.
But they were able to, upper middle class white women were able to go, oh, it's kind of nice to be able to go out the home and be able to talk. And
Totally.
And whereas, women had kind of been doing that for a while by that point.
Yeah,
and
poor white women, women of color were like, probably like, what? You know,
Seriously, it took you guys this long to figure this out?
Right, yeah.
Where the hell were you 100 years ago when we started working in factories?
Yeah, really.
Gone.
I think it's so interesting that we were having a discussion of LGBT issues, and we've so easily segued into women's rights, into racism and classism. And I think it's fascinating how really a lot of these oppressions, or I think all of them, really are interconnected in really kind of gross but very complicated ways.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean,
absolutely.
It's all the social justice issue, which is, and I think the part of the reason that the Occupy movement is as popular as it is, I think, is because it's trying to tackle some of the inequalities in social justice. And, you know, as opposed to kind of parsing it out to different types of social justice, whereas, you know, so you have the gay rights movement in terms of gay marriage, and then you have the civil rights movement, which is specifically African-American rights. And then you have the farm workers movement, which obviously was a more Latino rights issue. Mm-hmm. They're all kind of, I think, coming together or trying to. You have the people going, wait a minute, why are these such disparate issues? They should not be, there should not be categories of people going, oh, I care about this one thing, but I don't care about this other thing, because what we're finding is that they're all completely intertwined.
Absolutely.
If you don't have the one, then you can't have the other. And I was talking to someone earlier today about the fact that, you know, obviously the civil rights movement, it took a decade at least to even get for the civil rights fight to have some concrete action.
Well, I'm by no means an expert, but I wouldn't be surprised. And, you know, I certainly apologize to anyone listening who knows this better than I do if I'm mistaken here. But I would say that, you know, this struggle was going on long before that. I would say that it was really just kind of, as history here records it, that we're taught, at least in schools, I think how it's defined, unfortunately, is the civil rights movement was when white people got interested. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. Sadly.
Exactly. Because suddenly white people are interested, so therefore it hits the news. Yay.
And therefore it's a movement, right?
And in a lot of sense, you could say the same thing with slavery. I mean, a lot of the abolitionists, I mean, yeah, there were ex-slaves, I guess, who were abolitionists, but a lot of the movement, of course, because blacks could not vote, they had no political representation. It was all white people who were pushing against it. And of course, you had obviously the war was a big changer. Well, I would say changer with quotes around it, because it didn't quite change it. They were not slaves, but they were like still they couldn't get jobs, and they were like living on, you know, just they were economic slaves. They just changed the slavery to something else.
Right. And even with the Civil War, the problem is that it wasn't really about slavery. It was about a whole slew of economic issues.
Of which slavery was a very, very important part.
Yes, obviously.
That often, I get what you mean, but that, and you know, I used to make those arguments myself, but to me anymore, that, yeah, it was about slavery. It was just slavery couched in the terms of states' rights.
Right. That's, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's what I remind my students of. It's like, yes, slavery was obviously a hot button, but it wasn't just slavery. There were other issues which are all related to state rights, which, of course, the South was pissed about. Not to say that any of them were legitimate, but you lost, guys. Get used to it.
Ah, and we're having the fight again. Yeah,
well, we're but different kinds of fights. But anyway, this is all like wandering way far. We're like doing history.
Well, no, that's why I brought it back. We're fighting about this again today. Yeah. I mean, we have the whole idea of, oh, we're going to leave the marriage issue up to the states. And you're like, well, you didn't do that with, you know, multiracial marriage. Why aren't – what? You know, how is it not apply to gay people? And you try to argue that point, and they all look, you know, deer in headlights. What? You know.
Well, they make arguments. They make arguments about. There are a lot of really crazed arguments about anti-gay marriage. I'm trying to think of one that's the good one, but now I can't think of any, and I'm my brain is intentionally shutting down.
Yeah, it's just it's overwhelmed with the ridiculousness of it all, isn't it?
It is kind of. I mean, it's hard to. I just don't. For me, and I don't want to get into political, but I don't really understand. Like I'm rambling. Sorry. Let me calm down. I like
deep breaths. Deep
Brandon Sanderson. Breaths. Brandon Sanderson's position is a position that I have a lot of respect for, and I don't think a lot of people know his position. He's Mormon. He believes that homosexuality is a sin, which, all right, fine, you're allowed to believe that. That's perfectly fine. Freedom, all that good stuff. But he also believes that the government should have no say whatsoever in who is allowed to get marriage. He thinks that we should just get rid of marriage, period, as a government thing, and just have civil unions for everybody, and that your church can basically just decide whether to give you a church marriage license. And
yeah, that's a view I've heard before. It's a very libertarian view in a lot of ways. In
it
all
is.
Ways, I think.
Yeah, and yeah. I think to some extent, I think that would be in the present climate, I think that would be okay, because the reality is a hell of a lot of churches are more than willing to hand out marriage licenses to gay couples.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would probably solve our problem. We could stop complaining about it and just say everybody's got civil unions.
I've been trying to get a divorce for 2 years just to do that.
What? Okay.
But I think it simplifies the issues.
Sure.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but we're getting like way.
Oh yeah, we're going political.
We should let's move back to
sure.
let's go to books.
Okay, which are never political, Matt. Sorry.
Never.
This is true, but
I need to remember it's my day to be good. I need to be good. Sorry.
You only have one day?
Only one day.
Well, that's good. You know, one day.
Per week, per month, per year. I mean.
I'm sorry, Sean. Please go on.
Well, I would like to ask, because I know Jen has not read many books which feature an LGBT character as the main protagonist, so I thought that you and I would be able to offer her some lovely reading by suggesting some of our favorites of genre fiction that have LGBT characters.
I have paper and a pencil, and I'm ready.
So
go.
Let's start with you, Joe.
No!
Okay, I will start.
No, I only say no because I feel very unread these days, because between reviewing and editing and writing, it feels like I don't read a whole lot for leisure anymore. And I mean, it's something I don't like. It's something I feel very sad about. But I always kind of like to defer to the other person to get started, because then I'll start remembering things I have read and I can be like, yeah, that's really good. Or no, that's terrible. Or whatever.
Okay, well, I can start. That's easy enough.
Sure.
One of my favorites is Wicked Gentleman by Jen Hale.
Mm.
I know that name.
I hope so. I may have suggested this book to you, Jen. It's an amazing, amazing book. I love that book. I also really like One for Sorrow by Christopher Barzak, which is more, I guess you would call it queer than you would LGBT, but I'm not really sure where it's. That's a confusing book, but it's definitely playing with issues of sexuality, and I really love that book. So that there's my two.
That's it.
Well, there's more, but yeah.
You know, I always recommend Catherine Valenti's work. Mm. It's a lot of it is not all of it by any means, but a good chunk of it is very, very queer. I just read her novella Silently and Very Fast, which is gender fluid, sexuality fluid. It's this very fascinating, pithy. I hate the word pithy, but it just seems so right in this case. Pithy story of machine consciousness. That it involves fairy tales and history, and it's definitely a really good read. So everybody read it.
I'm curious what you both think, if either of you have read them, the Kushiel series by Jacqueline Carey.
My partner loves that series. I have not yet read it, so I'm afraid I can't say anything, but it sounds awesome.
The other reason I mention it is because it has the kind of gender fluidity that's completely accepted to the majority of the cultures in it. The main character isn't necessarily... you can't even really call her bisexual, although I suppose she is, because sexuality and gender make no difference whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because it's her job, but it's not really heavily focused on. And I thought it was a really interesting take on gender identity and sexual identity, more specifically. So
I really like Catherine Lundoff's work, and I don't just say that because we edit together and she's a friend, but I really think her stories are very her characters are just incredible. They're very rounded. They're often from very unusual I don't want to say unusual groups. I want to say you don't see a whole lot of lesbian characters in, I think, a lot of writing, whether it's spec or not, who are, let's be honest, above 35. And, you know, she, Silver Moon, which is a wonderful story she has in Bitten by Moonlight, which is my lesbian werewolf anthology, is about a werewolf, a lesbian who discovers she's a werewolf at about the time that she's going through menopause. So you've got somebody, you know, in her late 40s, 50s-ish. And I mean, and she does that a lot. She really kind of brings, you know, lesbians of body types and ages that don't get a lot of representation. I love that about her work.
Yeah.
Now, what about science fiction?
Well, Elizabeth Baer has written some science fiction, which features pretty prominently some queer, lesbian, gay variety, really, of characters. Dust is one that I quite enjoyed, which I think is probably her most, I think if you could say any of her work is controversial because of the kinds of sexualities that are represented, this one's probably the most controversial because there's a lot of hermaphrodites in it. I'm not a lot, but there is. It's
you mean
very
intersex
odd.
People? As far as I understand it, intersex is the preferred term. Or
oh, I apologize. Intersex, excuse me. Yes, there is one character who is both genders. Which is very interesting, and it's a really fascinating book. It's set on a, well, you don't realize it, but I'm not gonna ruin it. Never mind. I'm gonna start saying plot points that are ruin the whole book. Read it.
Okay.
It's really
we'll
good.
Read it.
It is very very interesting. It starts as sort of a fantasy story, but things start to kind of the holes start to break down. Very good. And she's written other stuff. I don't know if people have read Carnival by Elizabeth Baer. Which is maybe more straight science fiction, and which isn't necessarily LGBT, but it's certainly it's basically set where two. Well, no, it actually is LGBT. Excuse me.
So when you say straight science fiction, you don't. I'm sorry.
No. Thank you.
You mean forward.
Yes.
You mean yes.
Essentially, is these two, this couple, two gay men, are sent. Basically, because the Earth Empire wants to get rid of them and goes and sends them on a diplomatic mission just to get them out to this planet, which is essentially run by a female superior Amazon type society. Not quite Amazon, but it's where women are clearly in charge and are in the superior role, and men are subservient. And they think that they can send these two gay men because they're non-threatening men. And there's some mysteries and things going on behind the scenes. And it's a really interesting book, too.
Okay, so for all of the problems that it does have, and I'm by no means saying it isn't a problematic work in some ways, but I like a lot about Why the Last Man, which has a lot of lesbian or bisexual characters and some trans men in it as well. It's a really good comic, or I guess I should say graphic novel. To me, the terms, neither term is, you know, denigrating, so sometimes I interchange them like that. But I do recommend it for people. I think he could have done a little better with the race issues, but I really quite liked how he dealt with sexuality. And I mean, for anybody who isn't sure what I'm talking about, Why the Last Man is a take on the single-sex world where all of the men just suddenly die off, and there are a lot of reasons that are posed, and it's small spoiler alert here. You're kind of left to decide which one you think happened. But there's one guy who doesn't get killed off, and it's sort of about his journey to find his fiancée with this Secret Service, but it's a little more complicated than that, but this really kind of very strong secret agent-like kind of woman and this brilliant scientist who is right on the verge of figuring out how to clone human beings. It's a very complicated work, very moving in places. And like I said, I think he did a really good job of including women of all sexualities.
Awesome.
Now we can only hope that when Shia LaBeouf plays Y.
Oh, really?
Everything. Mm. That was the last rumor I heard. So I don't know if it's actually going anywhere, but yeah.
Well, next we'll find out he's in Akira. And...
Oh, no, no.
Don't bother looking at the cast for Akira. It's awful.
I can't even. I get a headache just thinking about that.
So here's a question. Do you think that lesbianism is more accepted in genre fiction than being gay?
You know, I never quite like these sorts of questions because I don't really think they have an answer. Nothing against anyone who asked them, Jen. So right. Please don't feel offended. But I remember... This is going to sound like a tangent, but I promise you it's going somewhere. I remember actually when I was very young, or maybe I was in my late teens. I seem to recall I felt very young at the time in this memory, asking my stepmother, who is heterosexual, if she thought that gay men or lesbians had it worse, which is, you know, kind of a screwed up thing to be asking a straight woman, right? Like she knows. but, you know, that was me, and that was a person I had to talk about these things when I was very confused about my identity. And her opinion was that she thought gay men probably did, at least on some level, because with women, at least in American society, we accept like handholding and hugging. It's just the, you know, one little part of like actually having sex that is kind of foreign. But with guys, it's like, yeah, if you like hug for too long, you're queer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But honestly, I don't really think that has an answer because on the one hand, yeah, you do have guys who... I mean, you do have, you know, a lot of straight guys who think lesbianism is awesome or whatever they think lesbianism is. But, you know, ew, good. You know, what's the matter? You queer, you're hugging too long, right? When it comes to men. But on the other hand, you know, you have the male-male romance movement, which, you know, is really kind of moved into paranormal romance. And, you know, there's certainly more of those out there than female-female romances of, you know, any genre. So... And then, you know, we get into the whole debate about, well, is MM, you know, representative of gay men? But, you know, the bottom line is you can find books where at least, you know, there's a male-male romance in it. Whereas, you know, I really have to hunt for, you know, romances for lesbians. So I think that it's in some cases, it's different ways that both sexualities are represented. And I don't really think that it's one is better represented than the other.
I actually have a follow-up question to this.
Yeah.
Because you brought up that there maybe are less romances for involving lesbian couples. I wonder if you think that perhaps because in our society, lesbians tend to be sexualized, particularly by straight culture, that maybe a part of that is that there are romances with lesbians in them, but that they are billed as erotica because of that. I mean, I don't know if there's an answer to that either, but it is a interesting thing. I think
there's a lot that goes into this. And keep in mind, I edit paranormal romance sometimes, but I mean, I don't really want to speak for the genre because I'm kind of on the outskirts of it, but I'm not really part of it. But from what I've seen and what I've reviewed and what I have read, I mean, the primary audience for romance books, just romance, erotica, you know, let's put that to the side for a minute, is straight women, right? I mean, there are guys who read it, I'm sure, and lesbians, but, you know, that's what the market is. That's what people who are publishing these things see as the market. So straight women are more probably going to find, you know, male-male stuff attractive or male-female. I mean, some probably like female-female, but I would say that's a smaller percentage. So, you know, conversely, if that's what you think the market is, that's what you publish. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of lesbian erotica out there, just like there's a lot of, you know, anything erotica out there, any orientation erotica, I should say. And there are, you know, female-female romances, but... If you're like, again, if you're seeing your readership is not being interested in them, they're going to have a harder time finding straight women and, you know, straight men or gay men who are interested and gay women, just because it's such a big market and there's so many other things to look at. And, you know, again, romance writers and readers do, I apologize if I'm wrong, do correct me. But that's been my understanding from what I've read and what people have told me who do work in that genre.
Well, let's move a little bit then, I guess, to something that a particular segment of publishing that obviously you are fairly well versed in. Do you think that perhaps in, say, the last 3 or 4 years, maybe 5, that things have gotten better for LGBT genre fiction? Have things improved? Are we seeing more of it? Is there more acceptance in the wider community? Is there a lot of violent pushback?
You know, again, it's kind of like the question Jen asked. I don't really know if there's an answer. No, it's okay. you know, you ask me a question and you get a dissertation, right? just kind of who I am. But on the one hand, yes, there are certainly more books being published. But on the other hand, if you looked at the chart that Melinda Lowe created during the whole gay YA debacle a few months back.
Oh, that's right.
It's a really, really small percentage of YA, which you would think of as being a very accepting and risky and risk-taking a genre, I guess, for lack of a better term. You would think it would be more, but it was something like less than 1% and substantially less. It was like maybe 0.5%. Yeah. It was not a whole lot, and this is major publishing houses.
Yeah, and that worries me because every time I hear some controversy over a book, it's almost always a YA book. You know, some group is irritated about something in a YA book. Mm-hmm. And it would seem like if that is the genre where there is more experimentation in terms of content, mm-hmm. why is there not more of those characters? I don't know.
I seem to recall, and I may have completely dreamed this, but I seem to recall when I was reading that hashtag and reading the blog post that came with that, that it really, again, comes from, it's just straight girls who are reading our, like, these romances, right? And they want to see, you know, straight girls and with straight boys. They don't want to see, but which is, you know, complete, it's okay to swear on this, right?
Yeah,
personally. It's complete bullshit because, you know, I don't know where these people have been, you know, for the last, 15 years since the internet happened and we got it in our houses. You know, straight girls love reading about gay guys. Or,
totally.
You know, I mean, maybe they get it really wrong and, you know, I mean, slash fiction, we could go on all night about, again, issues of representation there. But, you know, I don't know what they're talking about because, no, they'll read that. They'll read about lesbians. I mean, come on.
I'll read about it.
Yeah, I mean.
You have a gay kid flying on a dragon? I'll read it.
I mean, honestly, it's just the publishing industry, at least, you know, at least the ones who are rejecting this kind of stuff and giving writers crap, you know, they really don't, I think, understand what, you know, teens are doing and thinking right now. I mean, hello, they've grown up with the Prop 8 debate, for heaven's sake.
No, that's a really good point. The kind of environment they're growing into, I mean, it's kind of hard to ignore the controversies and the issues. So they're growing up in a time, sort of like, you know, I grew up in a time when the internet was the big issue.
Yeah.
You know? And this
furthermore, you have the fact that they're not only are they growing up with the Prop 8 debate, but they're also dealing with, like, the don't ask, don't tell debate.
Yes, which, exactly.
And the suicide stuff.
The whole reason that it's successfully been implemented is that the force as it exists now, the vast majority of it is between 18 and 22 years old, maybe 24, and they've grown up with being okay with people being gay. It's just kind of like, okay, who cares? Whatever. They're essentially all libertarians in that sense. but, I mean, it goes back to Sean and I have had this discussion before with other people in terms of science fiction for young adults and for kids. It's not there. It just doesn't exist. And so apparently the argument is probably in the publishing world, that's because kids don't read science fiction. And you kind of go, wait, what? If it was there, they'd probably – it's, you know, the whole chicken and the egg sort of argument.
Yeah, exactly. You don't know if someone is not going to read something if they don't really have – if they have few to no titles to look at. I mean, I don't know. Will they read it? It's –
Well, and it'd be the problem, too, is, you know, you release, like, maybe each of the Big Six releases one book out of the hundreds they release every year that happens to have, like, a gay character. Well, I'm sorry, but then you run into the problem of distribution. How do you get that book to those kids? How do they find it out of the sea of stuff? Like,
Exactly, you know? Which is, I think, the problem with, you know, some lesbian titles. Or not the problem, but the problem that they face, I should say.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Right, there's not really an LGBTQ section of the bookstore.
Well, yes, I don't think we need an LGBTQ.
We don't.
I think what we just need is that there. I think it would be great if maybe publishers who, when they publish stuff like that, maybe they reached out to activist groups or group, any sort of like LGBT teen group. There are thousands of them. Reach out and say, look, hey, we got this new book and we're really interested if you could show it to tell your peoples about it. Because that might, because a lot of it is about word of mouth, and if they don't know it exists, they can't talk about it.
Yeah, that's a big thing with I've heard that there are some challenges that small presses that do YA find is, you know, how do you, I mean they're wonderful books, don't get me wrong, but the question is, you know, how do we get, you know, like the 12 and 13 year old and 14 year old people, you know, who may not have credit cards and can't buy them on Amazon to find them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a problem too. Yeah.
And what are the chances of your local library carrying them?
Precisely. Precisely. I mean, it's hard enough to get small press titles in a library for so many reasons. Yes.
Right.
Ask me about writing about that someday.
Right. Add in the whole LGBTQ quotient, and when they're banning crap that you kind of go, wait, what? Like Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Or the gay penguin book.
Gay penguin.
The gay penguin book? Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Is it Tusa Tango or something?
Oh,
something
right.
Tango. Something
yes,
or Tango.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
it adds a whole new level of difficulty getting to the audience, essentially.
Yeah.
Precisely,
Yeah, because there's a lot of pressure not to. We can't give this to our kids. It's bad.
Mm-hmm.
It'll ruin their lives.
You know, as bad as that is, I really, really honestly do see. Sorry, lost my train of thought there. I really honestly do see that, I mean, and keep in mind where I'm coming from. I'm the daughter of a librarian. I mean, I knew how to use a card catalog when I was like 5. I mean, it's weird, but
awesome.
But from what I see, it seems like when you ban a book, you get more positive. I mean, do you remember that senator, I think it was, who like called Neil Gaiman like a stupid head or something? And like the whole internet freaked out, and like his mother made him apologize.
I mean,
it seems like when people do that, it does have, you know, consequences in that sometimes the book gets pulled, or you know, sometimes it gets burned, God forbid, because people are bizarre like that, or sometimes, you know, a kid who needs it doesn't get it. But at the same time, it seems like more and more people say this is really not freaking okay.
Yeah, that's true. It kind of it takes a crisis to occasionally.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of incident. I mean, there was something I told Jen about, I think last year, about a woman who was teaching a bunch of YA titles at a school, and she got a lot of pressure effectively to just stop the program she was doing because some of the books. Yeah, and you remember she got treated basically like garbage until she had to leave. And I can't remember all the details, but there's a post about it somewhere, and I'll see if I can dig it up again. But at the same time, it's like the amount of support this woman got for what she was doing, I'm sure that she got a new job somewhere, and they were like, "Yeah, we want go for it. If you can improve reading scores, go for
totally.
It."
Totally. So. I mean, it's always a bad thing when that happens. I mean, it's I mean, believe me, I know what it's like to lose your job, but yeah, I mean, it seems like you do get a lot of support. I do think overall, if we can say that there's anything about the American character, which is not something I like saying, you know, a lot about, because who knows what it is, but it seems to me that in this country, people tend to get really ticked off when you tell them what they can and can't read or think or speak about. So, I mean, granted, on the one hand, we have people who are trying to, you know, take that away from you every day, but it seems like as soon as you ban something, you know, people are going to be like, how dare, you know?
Well, for very, very, very good reasons. I mean,
no, exactly.
Yeah, there's a really disturbing history of that kind of stuff. And, you know, like, I hate to pull the Nazi thing, but you know, this is what the Nazis did, is they went and they took books and they made them unavailable to the public. Granted, they went and burned them all, but, you know, but, like, you can't sit there and say, I'm for freedom, but I want to deny, like, hide books from. And half the time, they're not even, like, you know, it's not like they're saying, I don't want Playboy in my library.
Yeah.
You know, or hardcore porn. No, it's like, no, I don't. The book mentions the word penis once. I don't want it in my library.
Okay, guys, true story. The reason that I love A Series of Unfortunate Events. It's honestly my favorite series of all time. It's just great.
Yes.
Okay, so reason that I my partner knows this story, and I'm going to forget what state actually did this, but this actually happened, that they banned the first book in some library. Okay, not because maybe it was the second book. Okay. Okay, my partner's listening. She said it was the first. Okay, not because Count Olaf tries to marry, you know, a 14-year-old girl, right? I mean, it's a sham, but, you know, that does happen. Not because he tries to kill people, you know, not because they're cousins were some weird, like, 17 times removed, but because he says the word damn, okay?
Oh, gosh.
And okay, she tells me it was Georgia, and that's what I was thinking, but I didn't want to, you know, malign the fair state above mine if I didn't have to.
Oh,
yeah,
goodness.
But let's admit it, it's Georgia.
Hey, I live in Florida. Georgia. I mean, you know, we're kind of, yeah, people just say Florida when I just say Florida to people, and they're like, uh-huh, sorry, Floridians. I love living here, but it's true. You know it's true.
Oh, yeah, I live here. I live there, too.
Oh, you do?
Yes, I live in Florida. I'm in Gainesville.
Oh, are you? I'm in South Florida. Okay, so you're kind of north. Got it.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And I feel sorry for both of you.
It's all good.
Yes, this state is a special place. We'll go with that. I'm originally from California, so you can imagine the culture shock.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Especially if you're in Gainesville. Mm.
Yeah, Gainesville's weird. It's just like we have all of the extreme politics here. There's a socialist party, and there are like really crazy religious wackos.
Wow.
So, the guy who did the Quran burnings is from here.
That's right. I remember.
He's
oh my gosh.
In my city. That guy. The guy who's now running for president.
He's,
oh.
What?
He put his bid in to run for president. I'm sorry. Anyway, we should go. Actually, have Giselle tell us a little bit about. I mean, you've said some about steampunk, steam powered too, but maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, give us the long winded elevator pitch. What should people expect from this book?
Okay, so if we're going down the Empire State Building and we're in the elevator and the elevator jams on, like, I don't know, the 30th floor, and I have to talk about it, okay, I'll give you that pitch. All right. So Steam Powered 2 is a continuation of what is now a series. We're going to do one every year until the publisher and I, or one or both of us, says stop enough. It's basically, I try to put about 15 in each year, 15 stories, which is, I recognize and fully, you know, understand and celebrate the fact that lesbians come in all colors, races, shapes, sizes, cultures, time periods. And I want to celebrate just how incredibly diverse and beautiful we are. And that's kind of what Steam Powered does, using not only, you know, various people's takes on steampunk, whether or not you want to do that in, you know, Europe, or you want to do that in, we have one story here that's set in, I'm blanking on it, on the name of the country. That's awesome. Well, we have one that's set in the former Belgian Congo. We've got one that's set in Zhao era China. We've got one set in the 10th circle of Chinese hell. I mean, all these different time periods. And I really just kind of want to celebrate not only, you know, what women who love women look like in those time periods, but the different, how these different cultures would take on technology and technological development, which I think is fascinating and not something that gets a lot of play outside of, at least here in the West, outside of people who are really, really into their gadgets or their history.
And that's your Empire State Building pitch?
Well, we could go on because we are on the 30th floor and it is stuck, Sean, but...
This is true.
I think that's a pretty good pitch. I mean, one of the nice things about the kind of the modern steampunk movement is the fact that it's so multicultural, or can be. Right, exactly, can be, especially when editors like yourself promote that aspect of steampunk. So,
I would like to see everybody doing it. I mean, there are some awesome stories to be, you know, written out there and that are being written, but I'm sure are not finding their market. Subliminal message time, send them to me. You know you want to.
I may try to write something for the next one.
Please do.
Yes.
I would love to see that.
I will try.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody try. And if I may just add one other project that I'm doing that's steampunk related.
Of course.
Dr. Fantastique's Show of Wonders is this awesome steampunk magazine. It covers not only steampunk stories, but kind of news from around the world with what is your steampunk doing right now. And recently, the publisher and owner and I decided that we were going to start a LGBTQ steampunk imprint for books, for novels and novellas. And when we say steampunk, we're not excluding things like dieselpunk, cyberpunk, mythpunk, you know, any of the punk genres. I'm interested in seeing it. And just so you know, our first submission window closes in 2 days. Well, 2 days from when we're recording this, so that's November 30th. Yeah, for those of you who can't play along at home because you won't hear it till after. But I haven't really gotten that many submissions, and I'd kind of like that to change when the submission period opens again in February. I mean, it's partially because it's new, and you know, I've had a lot of things that suddenly started happening to me during the time we were open, so I didn't get to promote it as much as I wanted, and I'm going to be talking it up more and trying to get more people, you know, to check it out. But yeah, if you have something that, you know, is 30,000 words or longer and has LGBTQ characters, or, you know, deals with themes of queer sexuality or gender identity, please send it to me. I want to publish it. I want to publish things. No, I really do want to see it.
It's nice when there's an editor. You've got everybody who's listening. You have an editor who's saying, please send me stuff, and I want to publish them.
I am begging you, for heaven's sake. What more do you need? I mean, I get it. It's kind of a genre within a genre in some ways. And I know that, I mean, sometimes there were some people who reviewed Steam Powered who were like, LOL, steampunk with lesbians. Isn't that quaint? It's like, no, because some lesbians and people who like lesbians like steampunk. Oh my God, shocking. But I don't mean that exactly, but I do know it is kind of specified in a lot of ways, because it's not just, spec fic. It's this very specific part of spec fic, which, you know, doesn't have to be, you know, tightly defined, but it is, you know, I'm not going to if you send me like something with like a high fantasy, I won't be able to take it because it's outside of my bailiwick, as it were. Okay. But yeah, do send me stuff, please. The URL is, Fantastic Gear Works. And let me just like actually type that in so I don't misspell it. And then people are going, what? Okay. Cause that would suck. Okay. That's Fantastic, Fantistique gearworks.com. It's a little bare bones at the moment. We just kind of migrated over. But yeah, you should be able to find them there. And if for some reason that site, you know, we're moving it and it's not there, just shoot me an email. I'm upstart.crow@gmail.com. I'm not that hard to track down, and we'll talk.
Excellent. You're on Facebook though, correct?
Me? Oh.
Fantastic Gearworks.
Us? Yeah, one of us. Yes, we are. It's okay. Just Fantastic-Gearworks. Just search for that and you'll find us.
All right, and that about does it for our show. Thank you so much, Giselle Vanderhoeft, for joining us today.
You still said it wrong, but that's okay.
Did I? What? No!
Vanderhoeft. It's okay. I'm just teasing. I'm just teasing you. It's not a big deal.
I said Vanderhoeft.
Kind of.
Okay, did you? It's not how I heard it. I'm sorry.
I swear I didn't say
hoofed. It was a cross between hoofed and hoofed, so it was.
It's okay, Vanderhoeft. Because if I really wanted to be mean, I'd make you pronounce it Vanderhoeft, which is how you would if we were in the Netherlands, but I won't be mean. I promise. It's hard enough. It's hard enough.
Oh, it's great. Oh, I get a little ribbing. This is lovely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
It was seriously my pleasure. This was awesome. Thank you.
Cool.
And we'll have you back again the next time something
please.
Amazing comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah, please. I would love to come back.
Awesome. We'll do it. So if anybody wants to send us hate mail or anything of that nature, you can do that in four ways. You can email us.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
Blog.
SkiffyandFanty.wordpress.com.
Twitter.
twitter.com/skiffyandfanty.
All great ways to do it, and of course will be lots of links and good things for Joe and everybody, and it'll be great. And you should go check out all of her stuff. Go get the we didn't get the day. When did Steam Powered 2 come out?
October 26th.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. October 20th. So both Steam Powered are out. Get them.
Yes.
Go buy
them. They're fantastic.
Get them now.
Not only are they sexy, but they are also intriguing and fun.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Get them.
They're like vegetables. They're very good for you.
Yes.
Oh, no. Let's go with fruit, because fruit tastes better.
Yes. They're like fruit for many reasons. Good night, everybody.
Well, take care, everyone. We will see you next week.
Bye.
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 Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.